Today's episode of the Cloudcast is sponsored by Datadog, a real-time monitoring platform that unifies metrics, traces, and logs into one tightly integrated platform. Datadog APM empowers developer teams to identify anomalies, resolve issues, and improve application performance. Begin collecting stack traces, visualizing them as flame graphs, organizing them into profile types such as CPU, I/O, and more. Teams can search for specific profiles, correlate them with distributed traces, and identify slow or underperforming code for analysis and optimization. Plus, with Datadog APM Live Search, you can perform searches across the full stream of ingested traces generated by your application over the last 15 minutes. Try Datadog APM free with a 14-day trial, and Datadog will send you a free t-shirt. Visit datadog.com/APM-Cloudcast to get started. That's datadog.com/APM-Cloudcast.
Cloudcast Media presents from the Massive Studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome back to The Cloudcast. We're coming to you live from our massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And it is almost the end of September. And as I click record on this, there is a pretty nasty hurricane headed for the United States. So if you are in the path of the upcoming hurricane here, please, 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 everyone stay safe out there, and thoughts and prayers with everyone as they go through this. And we are going to jump into cloud news of the week. First of all, wanted to talk a little bit about Slack. And if anybody has kind of followed me on Twitter, knows I have a, a love-hate relationship with Slack over the years. But this is actually something I'm super interested in. And it's had quite a history as well. Slack, once upon a time, tried to really have better document integration. And they've brought out something they called Canvas. But there is a Fast Company article that is in the link to the show notes. And it goes through a pretty long history about all of this. And in kind of classic Fast Company fashion, they use, you know, 500 words when 100 will do sometimes. But the gist of the article at the end of the day is Slack is bringing document integration, and it isn't what I would say a full-blown replacement for, say, like Word or Google Docs, which is how most of us use our documents and collaboration these days. But it is a step in having that environment that is within their ecosystem and all the tools built right in. And it is something I'm actually definitely looking forward to trying out here in the near future. And up next on our cloud news this week, really interesting article by Stephen O'Grady over at RedMonk, and talking about the end of open source, or the end of a certain model, if you will, if things don't potentially change. And I'll use the term, cautiously optimistic, if you will, because there's a pattern Stephen has been tracking, and it goes back to the roots of open source software and why it came about. And he talks about IBM and mainframes and closed source, and then open source came about and rose in popularity. And then, of course, we had kind of the closed source software era, if you will. And the article goes into in-depth into this new model that has recently developed over the last couple of years of bringing things out open source. And of course, developers want to work on those projects, but then changing the models over time so that kind of venture capital and companies have figured out how to eventually change that open source model, or figure out how to make that value in-house and not necessarily something that would be for everyone like true open source would be. And of course, Stephen goes into great depth about this model and how this could be really troublesome for the industry going forward, and that this approach is truly a dead end. And it's a very good read, a very fascinating read, and I certainly encourage you to go check that out. And finally, we have our third article. And I think we talk about this every quarter, but it is worth talking about. Clouded Judgment, Substack. They have the Q2 2022 public cloud software earnings report out. Big winners in Q2, Bill.com, ZoomInfo, Datadog, Snowflake, SentinelOne, Atlassian, Zscaler, CrowdStrike. But as always with these articles, it's much better to go read not just the highlights of this, but really dig in and figure out what makes these companies so good. And it's written extremely well, as always. Goes in, talks a little bit about consensus estimates. It goes and talks about growth of these companies. It talks about margins of the companies. It talks about net revenue retention and why that is important, especially with private SaaS companies. And again, really, really good read, lots and lots of data. If you're going to go check this out, definitely go get a drink, make yourself a fresh pot of coffee, something like that, and get comfortable with it, because it will take a little bit to digest all of it, but it is certainly worth your time. And with that, I'm going to wrap up Cloud News of the Week. And coming up right after the break, we're going to be talking to the folks over at ChainGuard about secure software supply chain.
Buffering, how annoying. Did you know that 17 out of 20 people stop watching a video because of stalling and rebuffering? Don't let your users click away to a competitor's site. If your business lies in online media, rely on CDN77 to deliver a seamless online experience to your audience. CDN77 is one of the leading global providers of content delivery network services. They power the world's most popular websites and apps such as Udemy, ESL Gaming, Live Sports TV, and social media platforms. Aside from their massive and redundant global network, you're going to love their no BS attitude and skilled team of engineers ready to help 24/7. No chatbots, no tickets bouncing around unresolved for days, just people who know your use case and can immediately help you pinpoint and fix the problems. Don't wait until your users run out of patience. Go to cdn77.com/cloudcast and ask for a free trial with no duration or traffic limits. That's cdn77.com/cloudcast. And we're back. And folks, as you know, one of the things that Aaron and I will always profess is we're always interested in what's going on from a security perspective in our industry. It's always something that's top of mind for a lot of people. May not always be their chief responsibility, but it's always something that you always kind of got to be conscious of. And from time to time, we go through certain periods where there's some high profile things that involve security, and a lot of us kind of dig into what's going on with that. And today we're really going to have a chance to dig into some things around how do we make sure that we know what software we're using. We're using software from a lot of different places these days. How do we know where it's coming from? How do we know that we can trust it? How do we know that we can validate it, and all those types of things? And so really excited to kind of dig into that topic today. We have Dan Lawrence, who is founder and CEO of ChainGuard. Dan, welcome to the show. Great to have you on.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
We have been hearing a ton of really, really good things about ChainGuard, a lot on Twitter, a lot in the community. So excited to have you on. Let's talk a little bit about your background, and then let's kind of dive into what led you to start ChainGuard and really kind of focus in this space.
Sure. Yeah, so we got ChainGuard started about a year ago, just under a year ago today. It was October of last year. So October 2021 for people listening later. Oh, wow. Before that, I was at Google for about 9 years as an engineer working on all parts of Google Cloud Platform, from back in infrastructure out to open source developer tools. Really through that is when I got into the supply chain security area and started worrying about it, especially in the context of open source software.
Yeah, interesting. And one of the things I found was interesting when you guys got started, a lot of folks from the Knative space. Was there a natural connection between this work in serverless and what you're doing with ChainGuard, or was it just like the right people at the right time, really good engineers?
Yeah, I think it was a lot more about the right people, but there were a kind of larger group of us at Google working on open source pretty early on. And Google was known for, it still is known for, having amazing internal security. The security setup there is better than anything I've seen anywhere else. And particularly around internal supply chain and controls around what the risk of a single developer getting their account compromised could actually do. And, you know, the world is set up perfectly. You know, it would take multiple developers to sign off on anything. A lot of the breaches we've seen lately are, you know, MFA stuff not being set up correctly or a single person's account getting hacked or something. And then being able to pivot from that initial footprint into like a full production takeover. And we had spent years at Google making that, you know, hard and not really possible. But then when we started working on open source, either in the Kubernetes or Knative or some of these other communities, we saw a lot of that stuff was just gone. You know, containers were built on laptops and, you know, desktops sitting under people's desks with Jenkins on Mac minis and that kind of thing. And, you know, it wouldn't even take much of a compromise at all to backdoor significant portions of like the container ecosystem at that point in time, which was pretty terrifying. So I think that's how a lot of us, you know, initially got to know each other. And then it seemed like the time was finally right. So we got the band back together to give this company a try.
Yeah. Very cool. Now we'll dive into this, but like, is, you know, the foundational technologies of what you guys are building, were these things that you were able to either replicate out of what Google was doing, or were you using them, or is, you know, a lot of this just, you know, principles and you started from scratch?
Yeah, this isn't really the type of thing that you can just copy paste, right? There's a lot of technologies from inside big companies that do kind of work that way, like, you know, databases and stuff like that get built in a large company and then they work pretty easily outside. But Google's solution to a lot of these supply chain security problems is very, very, very tightly coupled to Google's internal development model, which some of it's been exported and you've probably seen, like, you know, the Bazel Blaze tool, and, you know, Google's pretty famous for having a massive monorepo that all the code from the entire company lives in. Mm-hmm. And with that, you know, you get one way to solve a lot of these problems. Without that, though, when you jump into the open source world where there's intermediate package managers and lots of small repos on GitHub maintained by different people, the same technology, the same solutions don't really work. So you do have to step back and think about the principles. Like, what are the guarantees we're actually trying to make at each one of these stages? And then what would it look like to rebuild those from scratch in a more heterogeneous, multi-repository, multi-party, distributed trust kind of manner?
Yeah. Yeah, that seems to be the one core thing that everybody that was at Google at some point and decided, you know, I'm going to go off my own, I'm going to start my own thing. But what I would love to have is a lot of those things that made my life easy at Google is the sort of realization of like, oh, the rest of the world doesn't work like that. How do we make that adaptive? You know, over the last couple of years, we've seen some pretty, you know, high profile hacks, intrusions, attacks, and so forth. And I think more and more people over the last couple of years have been sort of learning how vulnerable software can be. And I think a lot of it, you know, probably comes from the fact that we're using more open source, we're using, you know, people are under tighter deadlines and so forth. But, you know, as you look out at sort of the software industry, you're starting to talk to a lot of companies about this. Like, what are some of the big things, the big areas that you look at as A, problematic, and B, that you're really having to educate people on?
Yeah, I think there's a bunch here. There's too many problematic areas to really get into. I think the scariest one to me, and the one that I still don't think the industry is really ready to deal with, is, you know, like what you just kind of touched on, of, you know, malicious code being injected on purpose into popular libraries. That coupled with the realization that, like, these are persistent nation states doing a lot of these attacks now. I mean, it's not going to end anytime soon. And these are sophisticated people. We've seen the damage that unsophisticated folks can do, or not to call it that, but folks just, you know, having it, getting really upset one day, deleting a repo or something like that. You know, having that being able to take down build systems across, you know, Fortune 500 companies is terrifying. Right. And, you know, imagine what can happen if somebody spends a little bit more time thinking about it and trying to cause actual damage rather than just, you know, delete a library they don't want to maintain anymore or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Right. What's the movie where the guy just goes crazy and starts shooting? It's been a long time. Much different than the government backed unlimited funding, you know, armies of hackers kind of going after stuff.
Exactly.
What are, you know, we're seeing, you know, some of those things, unfortunately, a lot of times are attached to, well, it was an old version of Windows and it wasn't patched and so forth. What are you seeing, though, in sort of the more modern space, in the open source space? What are, you know, what are the things that people should be looking out for? What are the trends that are happening? Is it just, you know, we emphasize so much innovation for a long time that open source just didn't, you know, they weren't really incentivized to work on these things, or are we just, you know, are we just seeing like it's become so much more prevalent that, you know, it's now the most common place to go trying to attack stuff?
I think it's the result of a couple trends kind of coinciding, sort of like one of those perfect storms or something like that. Yeah. One, open source really has become ubiquitous. It's hard to look back and pick an exact moment of time where it really happened, but sometime in the last decade, like it's everywhere, every right. single company. 10 years ago, you know, people were still scared of licenses. OSPOs didn't really exist. Nobody was sure if they were allowed to. There were all these, you know, vague FUD campaigns around open source and getting sued and stuff like that. Organizations were using it, not to say it didn't exist 10 years ago, but it just wasn't everywhere the same way it is today. And now it really is everywhere.
Yeah,
that makes sense. Then at the same time, we've gotten decent-ish. I don't want to say we've solved, because there's like a major breach every weekend or two. I don't want to say we've solved all the other aspects of security, but we have gotten a little better at it. MFA exists now, so you can't just compromise a person by stealing a single password or a 10-second long phishing attempt. HTTPS is everywhere. I mean, a lot of folks probably don't remember, but 10 or 15 years ago, you know, most pages on the internet did not have certificates, and there was a whole, you know, green checkmark, red X debates for decades. You're sending your bank passwords in plain text over the internet, and anybody on like that Starbucks Wi-Fi could see it, stuff like that. So we've gotten pretty good at hardening all the other ways in to enterprise infrastructure. Still not perfect, obviously, but we've gotten pretty good at it. And attackers are now just looking for the next easiest way in.
Right.
Supply chains are massive. The attacks look a little different. You can't be as targeted. You can't just look at one company, look at their employee list, fish a bunch of people until you get in. But you find a company that has a million customers or something like that, and then you kind of pivot from that company to all of their customers and hope you find something interesting along the way there. So it's a little less targeted, but more widespread at the same time.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned that you guys started the company about a year or so ago. You know, you're focused initially on secure container images, and then more on sort of software supply chain security. Can you kind of walk us through the types of things you guys are building, and you know, the parts of the problem that you're trying to sort of put a focus on?
Sure. Yeah, so we break down the problem space into a couple of different categories. It's a massive problem space, right? We started the company, like I said, about a year ago, in the wake of, you know, the first kind of nationally, you know, talked about supply chain attack, and that was the one, the attack on SolarWinds,
right?
Where likely a nation state attacker compromised some build infrastructure at SolarWinds, inserted a backdoor there into, you know, the binaries SolarWinds produced. And then those packages of software, they're actually even signed. You know, they get downloaded by customers, run, and a whole bunch of data got stolen in really sensitive contexts. And that's one aspect of supply chain security. Almost a year later to the day was another massive, it's incorrect to call it an attack, but a massive incident, I guess. The Log4Shell vulnerability was found.
Right.
Wasn't really an attack. It was just an unintentional bug that had been present for the better part of a decade in one of the most widely used components and the most widely used programming languages in the world. That it was about as bad as it could possibly be. It was like worst case scenario, but very, very different, right? There was no attacker that inserted that. Once it was found, attackers tried to exploit it, but completely different phase in the development cycle, completely different mitigations. You need to fix them, completely different everything. So we kind of break the space down into those two. It's kind of somewhat convenient. But you have integrity on one side, or, you know, build system security isn't really where it needs to be. Folks are still treating build systems like, you know, toys, running them in closets rather than treating them like production infrastructure like they should be. You don't, even if somebody hands you a package, you can't be confident that what's inside there is what they claim is. They can't be confident either. That kind of problem.
Right.
Then the other one is the like garbage in, garbage out. Like, you know, even if we fix all of that and we have the most secure build systems and pipelines ever, there's still going to be bugs. There's still going to be known bugs. There's going to be bugs that we find. There's going to be 0 days. Some of these bugs have security consequences, et cetera. And the more open source you're using, the more likely it is those happen. The harder it is for you to keep track of all of it, where it's running. I keep saying open source here is not only an open source problem, right? The same problem would be true for vendor code or proprietary code or any dependencies you're using. All software has bugs. The more you're using, the more likely it is to have these bugs. And so, yeah, there's kind of an inventory management problem. And a lot of the government regulations are aimed to tackle that with stuff like SBOMs or software bill of materials to try to help improve inventory and querying for known vulnerabilities and keeping things up to date.
And SBOM is this term that I feel like I hadn't really heard of up until maybe a year or so ago. And maybe it was because of it, you know, came to light because of these attacks. But like for somebody who's new to this space or, is wanting to dig in, it's like, what is, I know SBOM is secure bill of materials, but like, what does it mean? What is it? Like, what are the ramifications of now trying to have a standard around this?
Yeah, so SBOM, it's like a physical bill of materials, I guess. That's where the name came from, except applied to software. So when you buy a candy bar, I think that's one of the famous, analogies or demos they show. Like, you can read the ingredients list and see what's inside of it. And then if you're allergic to something or, you can choose not to consume it. Software bill of materials is similar. If you buy a piece of box software, all you know is that it's, version foo of package X. You have no idea what's inside there. Mm-hmm. And up until now, you just kind of had to trust it at faith that the vendor would let you know something was wrong with something in there and get you a patch. Unfortunately, that wasn't perfect. Vendors aren't always perfect. They might not even know you're running the thing anymore, because we're talking box software at this point, right? They might have sold it to you and forgot you even exist, or they got renamed, or you got renamed, or something happened in the meantime. Right. And you just didn't know you were running this 10-year-old copy of a piece of software full of vulnerabilities. So that's where SBOM is supposed to come in. And SBOM is, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so let's say I'm a vendor. Let's say I'm MongoDB, for example, and I sell something. Like, who's reading that SBOM? Like, how much of it is electronic and is checking on things? Like, walk me through sort of the mechanics of like, what does a customer or a user do with that thing?
Yeah, there's a couple different ways to use them. This is all very new. So first of all, we're not really seeing a ton of usage of these yet today. It's still pretty new. It's being pushed by some new standards from NIST and a bunch of other government agencies. But the way it's meant to work, and kind of depends on the type of software you're purchasing. So it's really geared right now anyway toward on-prem, packaged box shrink wrapped software that you ship to a vendor, and or a vendor ships to a customer, and it's up to them to ask for updates, to apply updates, to manage the system after that.
Okay.
So alongside that piece of software, you get this long document saying everything that's inside of that. You install the software, and then what you do is you look at that SBOM and you start querying vulnerability databases. So you say, I want to know if anything happens to anything inside of this. If a vulnerability is found, then I have to request a patch. So you set up little alerts or watchers or something for components. And then when something gets found, you request a patch, or you patch it yourself if it's like a third-party component that's sitting somewhere else. Yeah. That's basically how it's supposed to go. If you apply SBOMs in other contexts, though, like SaaS, then it all kind of changes, because you can't really patch it yourself anyway. So it's a little bit different. Right. But they're being talked about and used in a whole bunch of different contexts.
Right. Now, would this be, and maybe this is a bad comparison, like, I mean, I feel like maybe the most prevalent place where this would be like an operating system. So let's say I'm like Red Hat or SUSE or somebody. Like, don't they already sort of do this with what they provide to people, and then tools like Satellite or something like that? Like, is it the same sort of thing, or is this a very different concept? Because I always thought those tools were basically like, here's the software, you can query it, and then we have this thing that goes through and periodically gives you a way to patch stuff.
Yeah, it's not really anything brand new. Like, certain vendors have been doing it for a while. I think the big difference now is it's more standardized, right? It's a format that everybody can use. You can ingest thousands of them from all the different vendors you're using the same way. It's not these specific solutions. Okay. And it's supposed to go a little deeper, right? A lot of these other proprietary tools are more like, oh, you're on version X of our package. We maintain that internal database. We know what's wrong with all of the stuff inside of it. We don't really break down what's in there. But now you'd see that, if you're using this version of, RHEL or SUSE Linux or something like that, you get the full list of all of the third-party subcomponents in there.
Yeah.
And you get to query for those yourself rather than trusting them to do those queries for you.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's going to lead to a lot more noise, right? It's just a lot more data people are going to have to deal with and figure out which vulnerabilities to query against. But right. The transparency can be useful.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I mean, the standardization obviously makes a ton of sense. And to a certain extent, you know, you're responsible for your own, you know, for the thing that you run. I mean, nobody's going to go, oh, it's, you know, I mean, people can blame third party pieces of software, but ultimately it's your business to run or your organization to run. And so that makes a lot of sense. You're kind of putting the control of that back into people's hands. You know, for people that are curious about this stuff, that are interested in, you know, what you guys are building at ChainGuard, what's going on in the community, things like SigStore and other stuff, like, what are some of the best ways to sort of get involved with those things? Where are the communities hanging out? Where are the good conversations happening? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, there's been a lot of momentum in the last year or two. I still remember 2 or 3 years ago when I was talking about this, you know, I felt like the only one in the room that cared. And now there's, you know, tons of conversations going on Twitter and email lists everywhere. For SigStore, there's an awesome, very active Slack channel. You can go to sigstore.dev and find the link, and, you know, folks talk about all aspects of supply chain security and SBOMs and everything in there. For open source security in general, there's a new foundation called the Open Source Security Foundation, or the OpenSSF. And the SigStore is actually part of that foundation. It has a bunch of other projects too to help improve and find funding and, you know, make open source maintenance and patch management and everything sustainable. So they have a bunch of awesome working groups and stuff that you can get involved with. That's at opensf.org.
Okay. Yeah, and you mentioned SigStore. I had it on my list of things to talk to you about. Can you give us kind of the quick, you know, Cliff Notes version of what it is and what it's attempting to do?
Sure. Yeah. So SigStore was a project myself and several others started kind of mid-2020, I want to say, where we were trying to address a bunch of the problems with, you know, digital signatures in open source software. Signing isn't new for software, right? There have been kind of code signing certificates you can buy for Windows drivers and stuff like that for decades, but they're pretty much unused entirely in open source. PGP was kind of an alternative that addressed the problem in a very different way, but it never really reached critical mass in a lot of these ecosystems. It's designed around this kind of web of trust model, where if everybody has these keys and they exchange them in person at conferences and at parties and stuff like that, you can build a good kind of network of who to trust, and by, you know, looking at who trusts who and that kind of thing to get back to, you know, real identities. Well, SigStore tried to kind of combine a few of these principles. So if you look at Let's Encrypt, Let's Encrypt kind of stood up a free certificate authority for websites and for TLS by automating a lot of the process to verify you own a domain name. You know, they built a new protocol called Acme. And then with that automation, they were able to improve a bunch of security by issuing shorter lived certificates that automatically renew once a week rather than long ones that last for 3 years and you might lose or something in that period of time. So by combining a bunch of these other kind of technologies and copying the Let's Encrypt playbook, SigStore, we built a free code signing service for open source, where you don't have to manage keys. You don't have to exchange them with your friends or anything like that. You don't have to think about it at all. You just install these tools. When you want to sign something, your browser window pops open. You click login with Gmail or login with GitHub or something like this. And we give you a certificate that's tied to your email address or your GitHub identity or a machine identity in an automated context. It's good for 5 or 10 minutes or something like that. And you sign your package, do your release, and forget about that key because it's only valid during that window.
Oh, okay.
So it's much easier. Anybody can get started immediately. You don't need to go meet people in person and exchange keys. And it's free, so you don't have to pay for it like the old code signing authorities were. So with that, it's, you know, getting integrated into most open source language package managers. It's integrated into GitHub now and in NPM and Python and working with the folks in Java and Maven Central and RubyGems and kind of all of those ecosystems. Okay. So hopefully we'll be able to, you know, better trace a lot of these packages back to where they were built and make sure that they came from the maintainers you expect them to.
Okay. And are we seeing it in the people that run the big container registries, you know, Docker Hub and ECR and those sort of things? Or is it sort of expected that you would have signed it before you put it into the registry?
Yeah, so it just kind of works over those, you know, container protocols. That's where we started. You don't really need to change anything in those in Docker Hub and ECR and all of that stuff. The registry protocol was already flexible enough, so we just started there. Oh. Yeah, we're seeing a ton of adoption among containers. The Kubernetes project itself signs all of their releases and the containers that they build and release with Sigstore. So you can trace those back to the actual runs of their CI system and back to the source code and see who approved it and all of that stuff.
Oh, cool. Very, very cool. So yeah, it's getting widely adopted. Is that sort of becoming the de facto in the rest of the CNCF, or is still evolving?
Yeah, there's been a bunch of adoption across CNCF projects. We just saw that, like, Flux started doing it. A bunch, like Falco, I think, is investigating. So it's seeing pretty good adoption across CNCF.
Okay. Very cool. Very, very cool. Well, look, I want to be conscious of your time. You're running a company. Real quick, what was it like starting a company in the middle of the pandemic? You know, like, are you guys still completely remote, or have things changed quite a bit?
Yeah, we're still remote. We're all across the US and some folks in Europe and kind of international. And, you know, in some ways, it was probably easier during the pandemic, right? You know, office spaces, none of that stuff to set up. You know, I just swapped out which laptop I logged into each day, and because so much it was open source, still working with a lot of the same people. Yeah. But then, it was. It's been a lot of fun, a ton of learning, a lot different than, you know, a big company, but a lot more fun at the same time.
That's great. That's great. Last thing, if folks want to reach out to you, pick your brain, see you at conferences, like, will you guys be at KubeCon? What's the best way for people to engage with the team?
Yeah, we'll be at KubeCon Detroit in about a month. And Twitter is always great. You can find me at LORENC_Dan, or you can find the company at ChainGuard_dev.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Well, Dan, thank you for the time today. Thanks for educating us a little bit and putting up with our simplicity around security. We appreciate you diving into those things for us. Folks, I'm going to wrap that with that. For Aaron and I want to thank Dan for his time today. Thank you all for listening. Thanks for helping us grow in the show and tell a friend. If you get a chance, please give us a rating on Spotify or iTunes or anywhere else you get your podcast from. And with that, I'll wrap it up and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.